Veltberg had long been interested in the cholinergic nervous system, and he was working in Cambridge during the war when Adrian was involved in the development of these nerve gases. And because of his status as an enemy alien, Veltberg was not actually allowed to know what he was looking at. And so he used to give his samples back to Adrian, labelled L1, L2, L3, etc. And Adrian asked him why he called them L, and he was a great opera man, Veltberg, and he said, well, it stands for Lohengrin, because of the recitative Elsa, ask not my place nor name, ask not from whence I came. So anyhow, from then on, he went on working on the cholinergic nervous system and, well, on the nervous system in general, but he had done this work with Mars Vogt, which sort of predated the Hebb and Silver, and that was a paper which caused puzzles. The problem there was that there was very little, really, very, very little difference in the various regions. I think they only found a threefold difference between areas that were thought ought to involve acetylcholine and areas that didn't. And what Catherine realised was that this was a methodological problem, because the method that Veltberg and Vogt used was what we would call rate limiting. The substrate was not available to work at a higher rate. And Catherine adapted the method, and we made our own substrate of acetyl-CoA. We made it in the lab. It took about, 3 days. It involved vast boilings and stirrings and all sorts of things. And the acetyl-CoA was no longer rate-limiting. And we then got a big, big difference between the sensory system, virtually nothing in the optic nerve, for instance, and compared with other places where it was very, very high. And we did a survey of lots of various animals, and also, I think in that paper, we had a bit of a brain or two from Addenbrooke's, which was easier in those days. If you look at levels of now choline acetyltransferase, acetylcholinesterase, etc., which I did later, you've got enormous species variation, and also, you get heavy cholinesterase staining in some parts of cerebellum where actually the choline acetyltransferase levels are very low. So you have to be very careful about interpreting things. But obviously the measurements of choline acetyltransferase give you a much better impression of the or better results of the real picture than depending on acetylcholinesterase. And it remains, as I say, it remains a conundrum why sometimes there's a big discrepancy between one and the other. But now that so much more mapping has been done, and one knows where projections are coming from, they're coming, and where they're going to, you can have a much better idea of which cells are cholinergic, which cells are cholineceptive, where acetylcholine is actually acting as a transmitter. Well, in those days, we depended enormously on bioassay. And what you did was that you took out your piece of tissue that you thought would have choline acetyltransferase in it, and you then homogenized it, and you gave it substrate so that it could then, if it was choline acetyltransferase, it would produce acetylcholine. Now you had an inhibitor of cholinesterase there so that the acetylcholine that was produced wasn't immediately hydrolyzed. And then you measured the content, it was acetylcholine that you were measuring, on some tissue. We mostly used the frog abdominal rectus muscle, but you could also use leech, and you could use various blood pressures and things. And, of course, in those days, we didn't know what transmitters we were dealing with. We didn't know what was in, what other things were in the homogenate. And so you used, sometimes you used three or four different systems to see if they were all giving the same indication that what you were actually working on was acetylcholine.